History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. When we ask a few questions and we take the time to listen, we're always amazed by what we end up hearing. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And perhaps nowhere in the world is our greatest generation honored, celebrated, and detailed better than at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. I had the privilege of visiting the museum for the first time this week, thanks to some very special friends, and I've got to say, whatever expectations you have going in, the museum is going to exceed those expectations. We'll be talking more about it in the weeks to come. I got to meet some incredible World War II vets there in Louisiana and in Tennessee, and I'll be bringing you their stories in the weeks ahead. We'll also talk about the World War II Museum, as well as another organization making a difference in the lives of veterans in a unique and powerful way. But for this week, I want to focus on something that is certainly captured extensively in the vast array of information at that National World War II Museum in New Orleans. We have spotlighted quite a few milestone anniversaries in 2024, and as so many of you are glued to coverage of the Olympics every night, maybe it's worth pointing out that 80 years ago, in 1944, the Games of the 13th Olympiad, planned for London, England, had to be canceled because of World War II. London would end up hosting 4 years later in 1948. You may recall the 1940 Olympics, scheduled for Tokyo, had to be canceled because of war as well. So many tremendous athletes missed out on their chance to compete, and many of them ended up serving in the war. But one of the reasons the Games were finally able to resume in 1948, after what proved to be a 12-year hiatus, is the history that was unfolding 79 years ago this week. This weekend is sandwiched in between some pretty significant dates in World War II history. First, the deployment of nuclear technology for the first time on the world stage, and then the subsequent unconditional surrender of Imperial Japan as a result. If you were listening to the radio 79 years ago, maybe even on some of these same airwaves, you would have heard President Harry Truman, on the job for less than 4 months at that point, sharing this message.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industries, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We know now how close they were to finding it, and we knew the disaster which would come to this nation and to all peace-loving nations, to all civilization, if they had found it first. That is why we felt compelled to undertake the long and uncertain and costly labor of discovery and production. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
That surrender would come 79 years ago this week on August 14, 1945, made official a couple weeks later aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. but it was the atomic bomb that made that surrender possible without a costly invasion of Japan. Last week, we marked the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Tinian, and we made reference to the ill-fated cruiser USS Indianapolis delivering components of the atomic bomb to Tinian. One of the men who unloaded that secret cargo was a tall Marine named Mo Rana. The son of Italian immigrants and one of three brothers to serve in World War II, Mo was assigned to a radar unit in the 17th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion on Tinian, where he actually played softball with some of the pilots in the area, including Paul Tibbetts, who would famously pilot the Enola Gay on its world-changing mission to Hiroshima.
We took the island, and the B-29s were coming in, and the security was secured for the island with our radar and everything. We had a lot of time on our hands. And what would happen is the B-29 pilots from Saipan would fly over to Tinian, and we'd play ball with them, baseball. They'd come in with a team, and we'd have a team, and somebody beat somebody, and then they'd leave because they had a mission to go to at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the heartbreak of this was, if I played ball with you today, the next day when you expect them to come back to play again, then we got the word from their comrades that they were shot down over Japan. We were never seeing them again. That was the real thing that we had to look forward to. Are we going to see you again? But at the same time, we were enjoying ourselves with them. Everybody wasn't thinking about the war. We were playing ball and everything. But we knew what we had to do. And it was kind of bad. We as Marines on an island, we didn't have any food. We had little C rations, a little can of beans for our meals. No K rations, no anything like that. And every now and then, when the army start coming into the island, they start bringing up the food, like K rations and peaches and the fruit and all that stuff. But we weren't getting any of it. So the word would come out that a ship was coming in with some food, and they needed a couple of trucks from our outfit to go help unload these ships to bring the food to the army dump. So we volunteered. And so when our trucks come in time for the food, the word would get to us down in the hole, our trucks are here. Okay, everything that went on those two trucks was ours. So as they're taken off from the pier, it's hilly territory. You see this train, you visualize this caravan of trucks going straight and round and round. And at one point, two trucks go another way, and they went to our battalion headquarters. We used to steal a lot of food like that. So,
and something tells me that there was some food consumed on the drive from the pier to your battalion
headquarters. Oh, and in the hole, we used to break open those cases like mad and eat the peaches and pears. Oh, we had a hell of a time until we loaded up our own two trucks. The word come in one day to the Marine Corps headquarters that we need two trucks, two work units, to go down to the Indianapolis to unload a ship. They called on the Marines to do this because the Army was there, but they didn't fool around with the Army. So when we went down to the docks, we figured everybody volunteered on those trips because, hey, we're going to eat.
You're going to get some food. Yeah.
When we went down the dock, you've never seen so much brass in your life. We seen colonels, generals, majors, all over the place. Security was top. And we'd all look at each other, what the hell gives here? You know, let's get back in the hole and let's unload the ship. So we got down there in the hole, and all we seen was these big crates. So I says, okay, that's what they wanted loaded. You know, we didn't see any food. And we unloaded the crates on our trucks, and the trucks went to a certain spot on Tinian where there were dugouts for these two bombs, let's say now. These two crates were two bombs.
And you had no idea what's
nothing,
in the crates?
Not a thing. We didn't know anything about the bombs ready. We didn't know what we unloaded until the first day when Tibbetts took the B-29 and bombed Hiroshima. And then when they come back, that's the only time we found out that we had unloaded the A-bomb, two LA bombs.
And when you saw all the brass, all these bigwigs walking around, did you think maybe there is something special in these crates?
Yeah, well, we gave it a thought. We gave it a thought. Where the hell's all this brass come from? You know, we made all our own comments, but nobody ever figured we were unloading bombs.
Well, and of course, and you and no one else had any idea what an atomic bomb was. Harry Truman didn't even know it existed till Roosevelt died and he became president.
That's right.
So this was a new thing to everybody. How did you find out that they had dropped the bomb on Hiroshima?
The next morning from out of San Francisco.
You heard it on the radio?
Oh, yeah, on the radio.
Did it click at that point?
Then we says that's what we unloaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it came to us that that's what it was unloaded. Then the other one was sent to August 9th, Nagasaki. Major Sweeney was the pilot of that plane.
Mm-hmm.
It was a frightful thing to think about, but it saved a heck of a lot of lives.
I've seen official military estimates from that period that put it at least a million American lives.
We would have gone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because they were already, and boy, to land on Japan would have been a massacre. And they were ready to defend. They didn't care, but killing them would have meant nothing. They're all for the emperor, all for the emperor.
But what about you? When you realize that you and your fellow Marines, along that path of getting those bombs to the Pacific, had unloaded them from the ship and taken them where they needed to go, did that do anything for you to realize that you played a role in maybe the most significant day in world history?
While we were doing it, nothing.
Well, of course
we didn't
not.
Know what we were doing.
Right.
But after we found out, mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it was a big impression on all of us. Jeez, did we do that? You know, really meaning it in a group like we talk about it. It was unbelievable that instead of food, we unloaded a couple of atomic bombs. We didn't know what the hell an atomic bomb was anyway,
mm-hmm.
You know. And yes, the impression was there.
Again, that was the late Mo Rana, who unloaded components of that first atomic bomb, Little Boy, on the island of Tinian, where the Enola Gay would take it to deliver to its target. The last living member of the Enola Gay's squadron is our friend Norris Jernigan. Just saw him again a few weeks ago. He is 99 now. He'll gladly show you a photo of his 20-year-old self peeking out the window of the Enola Gay. But his Army Air Corps story began when he left high school after his junior year to enlist.
To Shepherd Field, Texas, for the Army basic training, because back then the Air Force was part of the Army. It was
right.
A division of the Army. Took my basic training there and then went on to the next step of the cadet program. Was sent to Denver and enrolled in Denver University for a semester. And that's where we had our first flying lessons. It was some small private field near Denver. I think his name was Hayden Field, but I'm not really positive about that anymore. But had my 10 hours of flight instruction there. Then after the semester was ended, came time for our school squadron to be sent to a classification center to decide whether we qualified for further pilot training or whether we would go to navigator school or bombardier school or somewhere else. Well, when we got to, it was in Santa Ana, California. When we got there, we checked daily to see what the list looked like, where we would go. The pilot list, the bombardier list, and the navigator list wasn't growing very fast, but the somewhere else list was. One day there was my name on the somewhere else, and so that was the end of my cadet training. We wondered why, because about 2/3 of my school squadron was eliminated.
Wow.
The reason they gave us was that they were gaining a surplus of aviation students to go on to the next step. So, you know, in the military, you just can't have people sitting around doing nothing. So we were eliminated from the program to free up the backlog of people waiting for further training. They decided to send me to Amarillo, Texas, to go to airplane mechanic school. There again, the wisdom of the military decided... I was mechanically inclined, and about as mechanically inclined as a black cat, I guess you'd say. Anyhow, went down there, and we laid around there waiting for the next class to start up. And after about 4 or 5 weeks, they called us together and said that they had decided to close that school, and we would be sent to a redistribution center, which was in Salt Lake City. Set up there, and... was there about 2 weeks, I guess, while they were trying to decide where to send everybody. They were just funneling them through there and sending them out. And finally, they said, well, they're closing so many of the schools now. We're going to be sending you out to tactical groups that are training for overseas duty, and you'll be going out of here as an on-the-job trainee. So they sent me to Fairmont, Nebraska to become part of a B-29 group. Well, I'd never heard of a B-29, but... anyhow, we went to Fairmont, Nebraska, worked in the motor pool for a little while because they sent me out as a truck driver. There again, the wisdom of the Army.
They keep checking boxes you weren't willing to check for yourself, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, you have decisions made for you, which I wasn't used to. And anyhow, I was there just about a month, maybe. And as the number of people grew, they finally broke us into three different squadrons. And there was the 393rd Bomb Squadron, the 398th Bomb Squadron, and the 421st Bomb Squadron. I wound up in the 393rd Bomb Squadron. And one day, one of the guys that was in the administrative office, which we referred to as the orderly room, was going through the personnel records and noticed that I had been with the cadet program and I just had completed a semester at Denver University. Called me in and said, I see you were in the cadet program. What are you doing driving a truck? And I said, well, you don't argue. You do and go where you're told, and you do what you're told to do. We had three answers, yes, sir, no excuse, sir. Anyhow, he said, well, I tell you, there's an opening in the intelligence office here in the squadron if you're interested. It requires some typing. And I said, well, that's no problem. I took a semester of high school typing. So he said, well, if you're interested, go over and talk to him. So I did. I went over to the intelligence office, and they decided to give me a try. So I went into the intelligence office as an on-the-job trainee. And I was with the 393rd Bomb Squadron Intelligence Office for the rest of the time I was in the service.
And that would really change your life.
Yes.
I'm curious, the time when you were in the cadet program, when you actually got to fly, what was that like for you, and what were you flying?
Piper Cubs.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I had never been up in an airplane before. That first takeoff, it was just so exciting, you know. About the second or third lesson, they switch around their instructors. I had a woman pilot instructor. And in the old Piper Cub, they had what they called the Gosport. It was the communications intercom system, mm-hmm. which was really almost like the old can with a string to the other can. You know? It was a tube connected to just like funnels that you would talk into. And started down the runway, and she said, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. She got to the high pitch, and I got so confused. I hit the left rudder, and we went out across the field. I thought, oh, boy, I'm washed out of this, too, now. Anyhow, we circled around, got on the runway again, and made a perfect takeoff. So I redeemed myself, but I don't know why I got so confused that I would go, I knew right from left, but that high-pitched screaming, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. Because you had to ride the right rudder because of the torque. You uh-huh. drift to the left. To stay on the runway, you had to stay on that rudder. That was exciting. And then when it came to the what they call the five-hour check after you've had 5 hours of instruction, then you had somebody come in that you didn't even know that was checked you out and made a perfect takeoff. Went out to the practice area where I always practiced. Went through all the routine of the stalls and everything else that I was supposed to do. And he said, okay, now take us back to the airport. Where's the airport? Always before, the instructor flew it out there to the practice area and then flew it back to the airport and then turned it over to the student to land the plane. I remembered a railroad track that we kept almost following, and so I thought, well, where's a railroad track? And I spotted it, and so I just wheeled around and followed that thing, and sure enough, it took us back to the airport. Redeemed myself again. But I was, you know, I was crushed when I got washed out of the program because, you know, you make such a big thing back home about you're going to become a pilot. I was going to fly a B-17, the biggest airplane they had at that time. And now tell them, well, I'm a airplane mechanic or I'm a truck driver. But, you know, ego enters into it, I guess. But anyhow, it was tough being washed out of the program.
And little did you know that you would end up with a lifelong connection to an even bigger plane, a B-29,
yes.
Probably the most famous B-29 of all time.
Absolutely. And when we first were cut off into squadrons, we became the squadrons for the 504th Bomb Group. And they were training for overseas duty, and they call them a tactical unit, which means they're actually seriously training for overseas duty. We, at first, didn't have any B-29s. They were using B-17s to begin their training. And then when the first B-29 showed up, I just couldn't believe what a huge aircraft that was. Of course, now it's very small compared to what's in the air now. But then the B-29 started arriving, and so they transitioned into the B-29. And the 393rd Bomb Squadron was really making great headway in their training. We started our training in the spring of 1944, and by the end of August, all of the squadrons, especially the 393rd, was complete with their training. They were ready to go overseas. All of a sudden, orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron away from the 504th and sending us to Wendover Field, Utah.
And that is where the first hints of a world-changing weapon would start to emerge. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, what was shared with the men involved, the lengths to which the government went to keep that project secret, and how this now 99-year-old feels about the history he's been a part of now for all these years. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and another special anniversary episode. This past week marked the dates on which atomic bombs were deployed over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in the week ahead, we'll observe the 79th anniversary of VJ Day and the end of hostilities in the deadliest and most destructive war the world has ever seen. 99-year-old Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California, is the last person alive who was part of the 393rd Bomb Squadron. When we left off, the squadron was ready to go overseas, but sent instead to a remote and desolate outpost in Wendover, Utah.
Well, never heard of Wendover Field because I'd never been there before, but anyhow, we got to Wendover, and what a cultural shock that was out there on the salt flats, away from everything, 120 miles west of Salt Lake City. The little town of Wendover was nothing. It was just a small casino and then a small state line hotel was all that was there, really, and few citizens.
And there was a reason they wanted you all in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly, and we found that out later. Well, about the second day we were there, the enlisted men, I understand the officers were pulled into one of the theaters and briefed, and the enlisted men in our squadron, we were told to assemble out in front of the orderly room. This lieutenant colonel hopped up on the back of a truck so he could see everybody and said, "All right, men, gather around, I want to talk to you." So he said, introduced himself, he says, "I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and I want you to know that you've been brought here for a purpose. You're going to become part of an organization that's going to be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Now, it's top secret, high security. You're not to talk to anybody. You're not to tell anybody where you're stationed. You're not to talk to anybody about what you're doing. You're not supposed to talk to each other. So I want you now to all go on a two-week furlough. Go home, get rested up, come back, because we're going to go into an intense training program and get ready to go overseas." Well, of course, we were so excited to find out we were going to be something special. But he stressed again, remember, top secret, security is high, so don't tell anybody anything. So we left to go on a two-week leave, but what we didn't know, he wasn't concerned about us getting rested up. It was a test to see if anybody could keep their mouth shut. Some of the guys, when they got home, had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. And they found out when they got back to the base, they had just casually mentioned something to somebody about where they were stationed or going to be involved in something special or whatever they talked about. There was one story that was circulated, and we never could find out whether it was true or not, but it certainly made an impression on us that they really meant business about this security. It seems that one of the guys that was going on leave, while he was waiting to get his bus, train, or airplane, wherever it was, decided to go in the bar and have a drink while he was waiting. So he's sitting at this bar, and a Catholic priest came in and sat down beside him. And, of course, he struck up a conversation. "I see, my son, you're in the service." "Yes." "Where are you stationed?" "Oh, we're out at Wendover." "Wendover? What in the world are you doing there?" "Well, we're not sure. It's some top-secret project we're going to be involved in." "Aha, yeah. Okay." So he went on home, and he had a telegram waiting for him. When he got back to the base, he was met by the so-called Catholic priest, who was in a business suit, was part of FBI security. We never knew who it was, and maybe it was nobody. Maybe it was just a story that was circulated to catch our attention, which it certainly did, because we realized that they meant business. You didn't know who you were talking to when you left that base.
Was it hard for you to keep that secret? Were there times you were tempted?
Oh, heavens, yes. But fortunately, I somehow or other kept it. Being at the Army Air Corps, we assumed it was some kind of a bomb because that was the only weapon the Air Force was using. Was bombed, so we assumed that it was some new type of explosive that would be used. Little did we know. Maybe some of the guys had college physics, maybe a higher education, figured out that it might be that. I certainly didn't. I had no knowledge of anything of that area, of what it might be, but I just trusted that it was a new type bomb that we'd be using and would shorten the war. And, of course, that was the goal of everybody, was to get that war over, because it was such a nasty, bloody war out there in the Pacific, and Europe, too, as far as that goes. And we understood after the fact, I guess it was after we even got back from overseas, the original plan was to put this group together and then split it in half, send half of it to Europe and half of it to the Pacific, and simultaneously drop two atomic bombs, one on Germany and one on Japan. With the war winding down in Europe, because it was so close to being over by the time we were ready to go overseas in spring of 1945, if that was the plan, it was abandoned because we all went over to the island of Tinian.
But I'm sure there are a lot of fascinating months in between there. And before we hear about some of the things you experienced at Wendover and what it was like to go over to Tinian, how about explaining to us what your duties were? What were you responsible for on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I was assigned to the intelligence office as a clerk, intelligence clerk, which meant I typed reports and I helped put together folders made up of maps and aerial photographs and whatever else you could put in the folder to help them complete their mission. Then when they would come back from their mission, they were always interviewed and interrogated, and then I would type up the interrogation report. So a good part of it at first was just typing. My assignment, once we were overseas, the Squadron Intelligence Office was combined with the 509th Group Intelligence Office so that we were just one large office. And Lieutenant Jim Hinchy, who was part of the 393rd Squadron, was assigned the duty of Air Sea Rescue Officer, and his portion of the briefings for crews that would be flying missions would to brief them on the air sea rescue. And he kind of adopted me as his assistant to help him with that. And so I would spend quite a bit of time working with him to put together information on where the submarines were operating and where the fleets were operating and where any amphibian planes might be operating. Because we received a teletype every day. Many people don't know what a teletype is. But back then we didn't have computers, so it was a teletype that we received either from the wing command or island command, I don't remember which now, that gave the location of all of these things, the submarines and the fleets and the amphibian planes, so that we could put together information for them that when they would fly their mission, when they would leave Japan, if they were shot up and knew they were going to have to ditch in the ocean, if you can fly to this longitude, latitude, go ahead and put out your distress call and ditch in the ocean, you'll be picked up. So we had that information to put together for that briefing. So that was my main responsibility once we were overseas to work with him.
Well, and I'm just imagining, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking about all the guys I've talked to over the years, and so many of them, they only know what they're experiencing. You know, they know their mission, or if they're on the ground, they know, you know, this situation, this fight, this foxhole, this battle. If you're typing all these reports, you probably have more of a view of the big picture than most people in your squadron.
Yes, that would be a good assessment of that, yes. Not the complete knowledge. We never referred to these bombs as atomic bombs until after the first one was dropped. To us, it was the gimmick or the gadget that we referred to.
And I'm interested in some of the things that were happening there at Wendover, because, again, we know now when the bomb was dropped and when the second bomb was dropped and everything that happened as a result. But at the time, you guys don't know anything, and this is all uncharted territory. So what was happening at Wendover, and what did you experience there?
When we went into training there, they started sending the crews to a different site to do their practice bombing missions, because they were using a heavier bomb than what the normal bomb would be. Somewhere down on the Southern California desert, when the crews would disappear for a few days, when they'd appear back at Wendover, where you guys been? Well, we were at Destination X or Destination Y. That's all. You didn't ask anything further than that. When the 509th was made up, it only had one bomb squadron, and the 393rd was it. There were other squadrons in the 509th. Each had their function. You didn't talk to anybody in the other squadrons because you never knew who you were talking to. Just an interesting note, when we arrived at Wendover, there was an elderly lady, Miss Merrill, on the base that was in charge of the furnishings for all of the day rooms. Well, it just so happened that the barracks that we had been put in, the group that I was with, it went into the barracks, was a room that we thought we could convert that into our own day room. We were told we'll have to deal with Miss Merrill because she's in charge of the day rooms. So we did, and we were able to furnish that and have our own day room. She was just a grandmotherly type, lovable person, loved everybody, and we were her grandchildren, and she talked to us, and so friendly. You go over to her apartment, and, oh, you have to sit down and have a cup of iced tea. Yeah, we all loved Mom Merrill. That's what we referred to as Mom Merrill. One day she wasn't there anymore. Nobody knew where she was. Later on, we found out that she was actually FBI. It wasn't. She wasn't what she was supposed to be at all, you know.
She was there to keep an eye on you.
Yeah. So there again, you realize, gosh, I don't know if I ever said anything to her I shouldn't have or not. But, you know, she was so friendly and such a sweet little lady. But we didn't find that out until years later, that actually that's what happened to her, that she was FBI and she was moved on.
Does that make you wonder if there are more revelations that could still take place, that you could still find out something that none of you have ever heard before?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
And what about the development of this weapon? Was there any awareness at all of things being tested, of capabilities being learned?
Not at my level. Colonel Tibbetts, of course, he was at the very beginning, he was given the task of putting together a military unit that could drop this special bomb. He knew about the bomb. He visited Los Alamos, and he was in touch with people higher up than him. So he knew about it, and maybe Colonel Payette, the group intelligence officer, he may have known too, but very few people knew what it was. As far as the development, I had no idea where it was being developed, and neither did any of the rest of the guys either, as far as I know. No idea where this thing was being developed. We didn't even know that they were going to test that one on the New Mexico desert on July 16th of 1945. Didn't even know that they had tested one until after the two bombs were dropped. Then we found out, well, yeah, they had tested the plutonium bomb, but the bomb dropped on Hiroshima had never been tested. That was the test.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That was the test.
So when you get the word we're heading overseas, what did that mean for you?
Excitement. We thought, well, finally we're going to get this thing done that we're supposed that we've been brought here to do. And so, yeah, we were all excited about getting over there. And I went over on board ship, and I wasn't one of the few that got to fly over with the B-29s. And we had a troop carrier squadron as part of the 509th also that flew C-54s, four-engine transport. So they transported a lot of the people. So, yeah, I was excited about getting, let's get over there and get this thing done. When we first got there, the crews arrived, started flying some practice missions with conventional bombs, flying over to Marcus Island or somewhere, testing their accuracy for dropping any bomb. Then, in July, got word that they would start flying missions to Japan. So they started flying what we call the pumpkin bombs, which was the housing that was used for the plutonium bomb, really, which was full of TNT. The thing was a 10,000-pound bomb, did a lot of damage when it was dropped, but it still wasn't the gimmick. Well, after a couple of weeks of that type of mission, we began to wonder, well, maybe this is the thing. Is it a big flop as far as I was concerned? It just, you know, it's a big bomb. It did a lot of damage, but, you know, with only one bomb, well, the B-29, not ours, but the others, were equipped to put multiple bombs in their bomb bays. You load a B-29 up full of conventional bombs. If you dropped all of those bombs on a target, it would do as much damage or more than what these one TNT bombs were doing. When President Truman, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin met in Potsdam for the Potsdam Conference, they call it, they put together what was called the Potsdam Proclamation, directed to the Japanese Empire, demanding that they surrender unconditionally. And the Japanese received it, reviewed it, and on July 29th formally rejected it. They wanted to fight on. So that's at the point, I guess, that President Truman finally decided, all right, go ahead and use the atomic bombs.
I've always been amazed by the fact that he didn't even know about the Manhattan Project or about these nuclear capabilities until Roosevelt died and he became president, right?
Exactly. When he was sworn in, he had no knowledge of the atomic bomb project. And Stimson called him aside and clued him in. And that was the first he heard about. And I think that's a tragedy, that a man stands in the wings that's going to step in as president if something happens to the president, is denied knowledge of what's going on. You know, what in the world thinking is that?
I guess that underscores how secretive this whole thing was.
Even so,
yeah,
there were people that knew about it. Of course, Roosevelt knew about it because he's the one that instigated the startup of studying the use of uranium for that type of purpose. Others knew about it. Stimson knew about it. General Groves was headed up the atomic bomb project. General Hap Arnold knew about it. A lot of people knew about it. But the vice president of the United States is the second most important person in our government. And he was denied the knowledge of it, which just did not make sense. And I have never been able to understand the thinking of not briefing him on what's going on, because Roosevelt's health was getting so bad that they just expected him to drop dead any time, you know. Mm-hmm. They knew he was not going to be able to serve another 4 years. His health would not hold up that long. They knew that Harry Truman was going to become the president. And you don't clue the guy in? My gosh.
And it adds to the respect we have for how difficult that decision must have been for a guy who this is all new information to, and he's so new to the job.
Yes.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come on this special edition of Hometown Heroes. How did a 20-year-old intelligence clerk experience August 6th, 1945? And how does he feel about that historic day now? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
Three eight thirty three twenty eight.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It was 79 years ago this week that the nuclear age was officially ushered in with the devastating use of the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. We've been listening to the last man alive who served in the 393rd Bomb Squadron, which sent the B-29 Enola Gay from Tinian to its target, now 99-year-old Norris Jernigan.
Well, you know, I had my 20th birthday in June of 1945, so I was just barely 20 years old when these bombs were dropped. You know, it was exciting. When we first arrived there, we were put in a tent area, which was okay. We survived in the tent area, and we were a few weeks in the tent area when all of a sudden we were told the whole group was going to be moving into other facilities, and they moved us into what had been the CB's unit housing, which was all Quonset huts, very nice ones, and a very nice layout camp. It was complete. It had everything. It had a chapel, it had a theater, it had offices, it had barracks, it had a big mess hall. When we moved from the tent area to the Quonset hut area, life was nice. You know, I really enjoyed my time on Tinian because I knew I was a part of something big. Plus, it wasn't all that bad. When we got off the ship, at first, they didn't have any place for us, so we were living in pup tents for a few days. And that was pretty rugged, spread out in what used to be a cane field. It had been a farm. The civilians that lived on the island of Tinian, farmers, used human feces as their fertilizer. So we were told, don't eat any of the cane, don't chew any of that cane. It could be harmful to you. But every day it would rain. You could just depend on it. Be bright, bright sunshine, and all of a sudden one cloud would seem to come up, and all of a sudden it would just pour down rain. Then all of a sudden the cloud would move on, the sun would come out again. Then the steam starts rising from the soil. So you could just imagine the odor that came with it. So it was rather unpleasant. But that didn't last too long, so we survived it. And then we went into the regular tent area that was, tents were spread on platforms, so we were up off the ground and on wood floors at least. And then from there to the Quonset hut area. But we weren't too popular when we hit Tinian. We showed up over there with all kinds of priorities. 15 B-29s with no armor and no gun turrets, with all kinds, like I say, all kinds of priorities that the other guys had been over there for months slushing around in the mud and the slush and air crews flying missions and being shot down. And here this bunch of pansies show up with 15 airplanes with just a tail gun, two 50 caliber tail guns. Right away they wanted to know what we were up to, and nobody could tell them anything. So there was all kinds of scuttlebutt around the island about what group was all about. And one guy even wrote a poem about the 509th is winning the war. After August 6th, the tone changed because they realized we did have a mission over there after all.
What was August 6th like for you?
Oh, it was exciting. Around August 1st, we realized that things were starting to happen because all of a sudden people started showing up. A lot of people in khaki uniforms with no military insignia, which meant they weren't military. Civilians showing up. A lot of high-ranking officers showing up. Even a naval officer showing up. What in the world is the Navy doing here? So we knew that things were happening because of all these secret meetings all of a sudden that only certain people were allowed to go in. We had a military police squadron as well in the group. You know, it just wouldn't be anything to notice that on the chapel, one of the MPs, one on either side of the door standing there with their weapons, just guarding the door. That meant there was a secret meeting going on in there. And a lot of the briefings were held in there. There were several briefings, and they were held at different places, but the main ones, I think, used the little chapel, which was another Quonset hut converted into a chapel. So we knew that things were starting to happen. So we had a lot of excitement. All these high-ranking officers showing up. It was funny. One day, a group of us were just sitting around talking with some of these new people that had shown up, and I was sitting next to this person that was quite a bit older than me, but we were just having a good conversation, and I just happened to turn around and look on, and on his collar was a star. He was a general, General Farrell, And that was where I met General Farrell, just sitting, talking to him. He was just a regular guy, you know. And anyhow, we knew that things were starting to happen. And then when the mission was scheduled, we knew that it was the big one.
How did you know?
That was the information we got in the intelligence office, that the bomb is here. It's going to be delivered. August 6th was selected as the date, and Colonel Tibbetts was going to fly the airplane. So he took over the crew of Captain Lewis, and Captain Lewis had to move over to the co-pilot seat. That was the privilege of the commanding officer. If he wanted to fly the airplane, the normal airplane commander would move over and become co-pilot. But anyhow, it was determined that Colonel Tibbetts was going to be the airplane commander on that mission. Then all these secret briefings we knew were briefing for this big mission that was going to happen. And we were all sitting around the office. All the briefings had been completed, and we knew that they were going to be taking off that night, sometime after midnight of August 6th, and sitting around in the intelligence office waiting to go down to the flight line and see them off. And my buddy Ed Schlesinger and I, who had the same capacity jobs in the intelligence office, we were buddies as well. We were getting so heavy, I had about to go to sleep. Our sergeant finally said, "Hey, you guys are you're going to go to sleep here. Why don't you go on back to the Quonset hut, lay down. As soon as we get ready to go down to the flight line, I'll come get you." Well, that was good news for us, so we went dashing off to the barracks, to the Quonset hut. Flopped down on the bed. When I opened my eyes, it was the next morning. He didn't come get us, so we missed the takeoff. Anyhow, they took pictures that night. It was a big affair. They had floodlights down there, and they were recording, talking to the crew members, and, of course, Colonel Tibbetts. The crew got in the airplane. They cranked up the engines and just started moving to taxi out to the runway, and Colonel Tibbetts opened the side window and leaned out and waved. Well, when I saw that picture, I thought, I've got to have my picture taken the same way. So a few days later, after that mission, some of us from the intelligence office took the office jeep and went down to the flight line. And so I had my picture taken looking out the window of Enola Gay.
A peek at that photo is one of the most frequent requests Norris Jernigan fields all these years later. You can see it at hometownheroesradio.com. The other question he's asked the most has to do with the atomic bomb itself. Knowing everything he knows now, was it the right decision to deploy that unprecedentedly devastating weapon?
I say absolutely it was worth it. Sure, it killed a lot of people, but any war implement does exactly that. And you hear a lot about the people that were killed when the two atomic bombs were dropped. But the firebombing that was done over Tokyo, which literally burned Tokyo down, did more property damage and killed more people than the two bombs did together. So I always say that dropping the two bombs killed a lot of people, but it saved more lives than the number that were killed. The invasion of Japan was scheduled for November 1st. Dropping those two bombs ended the war and negated that invasion. They were massing troops on Okinawa and the Philippines to make that massive invasion. The Japanese knew it and were moving troops down to that area to welcome them. And I heard one figure that the first wave of forces going into the beaches would probably be 100% fatality. And, you know, that's just gives you shivers. You talk about lives. In the military, we were all just numbers. And every action, they knew that certain numbers of them would be killed. But it was necessary to carry out the missions. I've had so many people through the years say, "Oh, thank God for what you guys did. My grandfather was on Okinawa with the invading force in training, getting ready for that invasion." Or my grandfather or my uncle or my dad was on Philippines with the invading force. What you guys did stopped that invasion. So they said, "Thank you for that, or I wouldn't be here." You know, and they're right. So it would have been the bloodiest battle in the world's history, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, I've heard all kinds of speculation about, oh, no, it wouldn't have been that, you know, but just face the facts, for heaven's sakes.
Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and by the way, the airplane name was Enola Gay, he had that name painted on the fuselage of the airplane the day before they flew that raid on Hiroshima. And it was his mother's name because he so respected his mother. She's the one that encouraged him to go ahead and get into flying. And his father had different idea. He had determined that young Paul would go to the medical school, but young Paul was taking flying lessons and he just learned to love flying and he wanted to continue that. So his mother told him, "Oh, if that's where your heart is, go for it." And she helped explain that to his dad, which was necessary. He had never done it alone. But his dad finally said, well, I don't care. If you want to go ahead and kill yourself, go ahead and do it. Well, as a result, young Paul became an Army Air Corps cadet, took the flight training, got his wings, and eventually wound up being an airplane group commander of a B-17 group in Europe. He was given the assignment to put together this 509th group that would be entrusted with dropping the two atomic bombs. Actually, there were more to come. There was a third bomb that had not left the States yet, but there was one of our airplanes was here, and I understand the bomb was loaded on it, ready to fly it to Tinian to be used on the next atomic bomb mission. But it only took two of the bombs to convince the Japanese that we had more than one. Speculation is that they thought we only had one, so we destroyed Hiroshima, and they went on business as usual, thinking that they could eventually turn the war around and win it still. But it was an impossibility. They were completely beaten, really, before the two atomic bombs were dropped, but would not admit it and give up. So, anyhow, Colonel Tibbetts stayed in the military and retired as a brigadier general, and he used to come to some of our reunions when he could. But almost invariably, when he did come to one of our reunions, there'd be a reporter there that would shove a microphone in his face and say, aren't you sorry for what you did? So he finally developed a response to that and had it put in print. It said, the morality of dropping that bomb was not my business. I was given a military mission to complete, and I did it to the best of my ability, period. And that says it all.
You don't hear much criticism about the napalm bombs, which are just a horrible weapon of just literally burning people up with that napalm. You don't hear anything about that, you know. But the two atomic bombs were so inhumane, you know. Should never have done it. We should have dropped one out in the ocean just to demonstrate to the Japanese the force of it. Well, what damage would it have done out there? It probably killed a bunch of fish, but, you know, it had to be done. That was the reason it was developed. That was the reason it was used. And the use of it stopped the war, as far as I'm concerned. I'm glad they were dropped. No question about it. I'm glad they've never been used again. I hope they never will be. We never learn from our wars. We think we do. We think, oh, this is the one that'll end all wars. Well, that's what World War I was for. That's what World War II was for. Well, we've been in war ever since World War II, in one place or another. It hasn't ended the wars. You know, as long as there's people on this earth, there's going to be wars in some form or another until the end of time when Christ comes back. He'll put a stop to the whole thing, and it'll be set straight again. But as long as there's people, and people choose to hate, and there is so much hate in the world right now, that how can we ever get together and solve any problems? There's only one answer, and that's Christ. He's the answer, and if we would get the whole world to turn to Christ, that would solve all of our problems.
When August 6th comes around on the calendar every year, what do you think about? What crosses your mind on that date each year?
I'm still proud of the fact that I was part of something big. My job was not that big. I was a clerk in the intelligence office. I never touched either of those bombs. Never actually saw one. The one I saw was covered with canvas, so I didn't actually see the bomb. So, you know, just knowing that I was part of something that big that at least stopped war for a little while. That war in the Pacific was so, so cruel and bloody. It was terrible, absolutely terrible for both sides. At that point in my life, I had a great strong hate for the Japanese. But once the war was over, I feel like it's time to set things aside, restore our respect for each other, and let's go on from there and try to make it a better world. And I think in a lot of ways that happened for a while.
That's just a part of your life. Part of your life that I'm sure has influenced a whole lot of your life. But yeah, when you look back, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Yes, my marriage. I met my wife about 2 weeks after I was discharged from the service, and we just hit it off from the very beginning. And by December of that year, we were married. When she passed away, we'd been married 68 years as of December 29th, 2014. And she passed away then in April 2015, very suddenly. Proud of those 68 years. Just a great life.
What still motivates you or keeps you going?
Just to keep going. You know, I just have to assume that I'm here, still here, because God has something for me to do. I don't know what it is. May never know. But I think once it's accomplished, if it's ever completely accomplished, then God will say, okay, come on home.
That day has not yet come. In fact, Norris Jernigan has plans to celebrate his 100th birthday in the Holy Land in June of 2025. If you think you might be interested in going with him, let me know. A lot has been written about the first couple of weeks of August 1945, but there is no substitute for hearing from someone who lived that history firsthand. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.